Thank you. I want to start by talking about something that struck me as very interesting in reading a series of interviews with Noam Chomsky. Noam Chomsky is one of the leading voices of resistance in this country, although he's generally shut out of any forum of the, in the mainstream, which is what I'm going to talk about in a second. And he's also a world-famous linguist who's made a lot of breakthroughs in the whole field of linguistics and the relation between language and knowledge. And he's widely respected as an intellectual throughout the entire world, while again shut out of any mainstream voice in this country. And in these interviews called Chronicles of Dissent, he was speaking precisely to this question of why it is that he's not allowed on, you know, CNN, MSNBC, forget about Fox, and all the rest of them. And he quoted Jeff Greenfield on CNN saying, and in response to the question, why don't you have Noam Chomsky on these programs along with all these other pundits? And Jeff Greenfield replied, Noam Chomsky, we don't have him on because he's from the planet Saturn. In other words, he doesn't fit into the acceptable framework. And then Chomsky pointed out, Greenfield went on to say something that had more truth to it. He said, Chomsky has a problem with concision. He's not concise enough. And Chomsky said, well, actually, there's some truth to this. He said, I do have difficulty making my observations fit into these little two-minute slots between commercials. And he said, I'll tell you why. This was back in the 80s when the Soviet Union still existed. He said, if I go on television and I say the Soviet Union's no good and does terrible things in the world, that's all I have to say. Nobody will argue with me. Nobody will challenge me. I don't have to provide any evidence, any documentation, or do any concrete analysis of anything. But as soon as I start talking about the crimes that have been committed by the U.S. all around the world, then everybody challenges everything I say. And if I don't have 20 minutes, I can't begin to really get into all this. So I do have a problem with concision in that sense. Well, you might wonder why I'm bringing all this up. The reason is because I find myself in the same position in a very real sense as Noam Chomsky. Because what I'm going to say about democracy and the related questions here is not only radically different from what's said on the mainstream all the time, but is very different from what's generally the conventional wisdom and what's accepted among much of the progressive forces on the so-called or real left in this society and around the world. So therefore, it's going to take us a while to get into all this. So what I suggest is everybody get comfortable in your seats, metaphorically put on your seat belts, and we'll take this ride together. And I'm hoping that by the time that I'm through speaking, some questions will be answered or at least put in a different perspective, while many new ones will be posed. So with that, let me get more directly into it. Let me start with a one-question quiz that I imagine many of you at least will be able to answer. Who said the following? Quote, the extremists attacking our forces in Iraq should know that they will not succeed in dividing America or in sapping American resolve or in forcing the premature withdrawal of U.S. troops. Of course, the answer is John Kerry. He said that in April, and he said many things similar to that since then. And he went on at that occasion to say, speaking about the occupation of Iraq and everything involved with that, no matter who is elected president in November, we will persevere in that mission. Well, you can't say he didn't tell you straight up. But there's a deeper question here. Why does Kerry take this stand? And why is someone like Kerry, with such a stand, the nominee of the Democratic Party? Well, if we listen at all and we're willing to accept what we hear, they tell us all the time, the pundits on the mainstream media, commentators who carry that kind of cachet, who have that kind of authority, continually push this message at Kerry and at the rest of us. There's a difference, as one of them put it, between protesting and being president. When you were a Vietnam vet protesting against the Vietnam War, that's one thing. If you want to be president, that's a very different thing. What you did as a protester, you do not do if you are serious about becoming president. And this can be seen very graphically in the platform that the Democratic Party has already formulated going into their convention. There was an article about it in the USA Today a couple of days ago. And they described it very accurately as a very aggressive war platform. And that the question being posed, which the Democrats readily accept as the question they want to have at the focus of the election, is who can be the best commander-in-chief? And today there was an article in the newspaper talking about how Kerry is instructing all of his followers and orchestrating and choreographing the convention coming up that they should, quote-unquote, emphasize the positive. In other words, more building up of the positive side of Kerry and not very much Bush bashing. Why? Why is that what they're doing? Many people out here are very much aware of all this, and they say, well, right now they're holding their nose. I'm sure by the time of the election they'll need a cloth entirely over their face. They say, I know all that about Kerry, but still we got to get rid of Bush. And many people want this election to be a referendum about the Bush program, and in particular the whole war program, the whole juggernaut of war and repression, this rolling monster that's unfolding. Well, this election, as they're telling us, will be a referendum on war, but not in the way we might like and many people who want to vote for Kerry would wish. It is, as they are saying explicitly, going to be a referendum, if you will, on who can be the best commander-in-chief, who has the best war program to carry out the so-called war on terror. Now, let's talk a little bit, in order to shed more light on this, about how did Kerry get to be the nominee? One of the things they count on in this country is a short memory. Everybody needs to have it. It's very much embedded in the culture. You know, oh, that's so totally 5 minutes ago. So you're supposed to have political amnesia. As soon as something, they go on to the next thing, then you're supposed to have political amnesia. All of a sudden now, you know, Kerry's the candidate, and that's as if, you know, God ordained it from the time immemorial. And we're supposed to forget that just not that many months ago, Kerry was not the leading contender, but Howard Dean was. Going into the caucuses in Iowa in February, Dean was a front runner. And what are the caucuses in Iowa? They're groupings of Democratic Party functionaries. They're not even a popular vote. Well, these Democratic Party functionaries, under pressure from the Democratic Party leadership, no doubt, selected Kerry and didn't vote very much for Dean. And that was the beginning of the end for Dean. All of a sudden, you remember the night after, now if we can get our memories back, the night after that, those Iowa caucuses, Dean, who'd been up for 24 hours, got up and gave a speech in which he appeared to be glowing too much. And all of a sudden, he was like, you know, presented as if he were a madman. A person like this could never be responsible to be chief executive and commander-in-chief. And the media all play this up, even as we pointed out in our newspaper, The Revolutionary Worker. They play this up by how they presented things, on the television media. They cut out certain parts of it so it made it look as if he were just going mad right in front of everybody. And they put a certain framework and context on this, so all of a sudden Dean just went into the dumpster. And Kerry came to the fore. All through the manipulation of the Democratic Party leadership and the forces behind them. And what was Dean's great crime? Dean, as we pointed out in articles on him in our newspapers, doesn't have a program that's very progressive. He wasn't even a consistent opponent of the Iraq War. But he did two things that ruled him out of order, although he had a certain role to play. One was, he did sort of pose this as voting for me is getting America back, going against this whole thrust of what Bush is doing. That had to be ruled out of order. The other was, he said, I'm going to raise money through my own means on the internet. Instead of a few thousand people giving $1 million, I'm going to have millions of people give $100, and that's how I'm going to raise my funds. Well, that wasn't any good either. But he did play a certain role. Although he was not going to be allowed to be the candidate, he played the role of making people feel as if they had some stake in this election, as if the Democratic Party could be a vehicle through which they could actually effectively oppose the whole thing that Bush is pushing. and the forces around him. I know, for example, someone told me they had a friend who's very progressive, who's in their 40s, who quit a well-paying job to go be a volunteer for Dean because they felt this could actually make a difference. And then you know how the logic goes. Well, okay, your candidate isn't going to be the nominee. Dean's not going to be the nominee. But still, now that you've gotten in and it feels kind of good to be in here, you can't leave now. And if you feel like leaving, just remember Bush. And obviously this has a real pull on people for real reasons. Now I think another way to get at this and understand what actually goes on here and the actual dynamics involved and the actual interests at play and how they get pursued is to think of the elections and in particular the primaries as auditions. Now it's very important to understand what people are auditioning for and for whom they're auditioning. The candidates are not auditioning for you and me and the rest of the people. They are auditioning for the people who control the money, who control the media, who run things behind the scenes. And the form of that audition is not simply, they have to operate on two tracks. One is, okay, look, I can pursue your interests better than these other people. I will uphold them and be firm in standing for your interests better than these other people. And the other one is, I can influence the people out here in the way you need them to be influenced better than these other candidates. So these two things are going on. These two tracks are always operating. And this is what the audition is. But ultimately, even the second thing, even the way that you manipulate and influence the people is all part of the audition for the people who really count, the ones who are really making the decisions about who's going to run, who are the legitimate candidates, and what are the legitimate issues. If you think back to the movie Bullworth, there was a scene in Bullworth which actually got at this fairly well. You remember the movie Bullworth? It was Warren Beatty, and he had some attack of truth. He kind of lost his mind for a while and started telling the truth without any concern for the consequences. And he started acting all crazy, but a lot of truth came out. And at one point, he went to one of these candidates' debate forums. And there were all these newsmen sitting there, you know, like the Jim Lehrer who does it for the presidential thing, asking the candidates questions. And before it started, he started laughing and saying, well, this is really wild. The same people that finance me and my opponent here are the people who finance you to come here and ask us these questions. And I was getting at some fundamental truth. This is the way this game is run. And is this the way that real decisions get made in the society? Now, in the introduction, Dolly read the quote, which I want to come back to from my book, Democracy Can't We Do Better Than That, about the real role of elections in this kind of society. To illustrate this, let's look at two elections during most of our lifetimes, or some of our lifetimes, anyway, in fairly recent times, and how they actually related to changes of a major kind in society and the world. First, let's look at the election of 1964. It was Johnson versus Goldwater. Goldwater was the crazy maniac conservative. And he was. I mean, he was out there with all kinds of reactionary shit. And Johnson all of a sudden became the champion of civil rights. I remember back when I was a little younger, all of my friends used to refer to Johnson as lynching Baines Johnson. Because he was from Texas and he was a powerful force who actually killed several civil rights bills and several bills that would have made it easier for black people to be able to vote in the South. But all of a sudden, the needs of the ruling class and the times brought about a change in Johnson, and he took on a new face and even some new policies. And I confess that this was the first year at that time that I was eligible to vote. And I actually voted for Lyndon Johnson. There was a big struggle in the movement at that time about whether we should vote for Johnson or not. And I got convinced to vote for Johnson because, among other horrendous things, Goldwater was going to greatly escalate the Vietnam War, tremendously increase the bombing of Vietnam, send more troops, and all the rest of it. Well, Johnson won in a landslide and even ran some ads in his campaign portraying Goldwater in this light as a crazy man who would escalate the war in Vietnam. Within a few months after being reelected, Johnson himself greatly escalated the Vietnam War. starting a process that ended up sending hundreds of thousands of more troops to Vietnam and increasing the bombing. And of course, he was going to do that all along. The election is not the arena in which these kinds of major decisions get made. It's a means of pulling people in to make them feel they have a voice in these things when the decisions are actually being made somewhere else by the people who really run things. And let's look at the other side of it. In 1972, also having to do with the Vietnam War. In 1972, McGovern ran as a Democratic Party candidate. And we were all told that we had to vote for McGovern in order to end the Vietnam War, that Nixon was going to escalate the war yet again. And there was even struggle. I was part of the Revolutionary Union, the forerunner of our party at that time. We had struggle inside of our own ranks about this. Some people were arguing inside the RU that this was our internationalist duty to vote for McGovern. It was our duty to the Vietnamese people because otherwise horrors would be brought down on them by Nixon. We struggled this through and decided that was not correct, that that wasn't the way that support for the Vietnamese people should be exercised, and in fact it would work against it. Well, what happened? Nixon beat McGovern in a landslide, and within several months, Nixon was forced to sign an agreement in January of 1973, which set in motion the process which led to the complete withdrawal of the U.S. and eventually 2 years later to the collapse of the puppet regime it had installed in South Vietnam. In neither case did the elections have anything to do with these major decisions and changes in the world. What they had to do with was trying to convince, especially progressive people, when it comes down to you can protest for 3 3/4 years, but then the only thing you can effectively do is vote for a Democrat. And the same beat goes on election after election after election. But many people say, yes, all that's true, but this is different. Anything is better than Bush. So let's get into this more fully still. Now let's talk honestly about what is represented by Bush. I referred to this juggernaut, this rolling monster of war and repression. This is very serious. The program they have unleashed and are determined to carry forward is very serious and pose very grave dangers to people all over the world and people in this country. And we have to take it very seriously. I was reading an article today, Iran, A Darker Shadow Than Iraq, by Walter Russell Mead, a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. It was an article in the LA Times. And he's raising the prospect of war with Iran and how the unfolding of events, even if they try negotiating, may lead to the necessity to have a war with Iran anyway, supposedly over the issue of Iran's insistence on developing nuclear power and the threat of their using nuclear weapons, including against Israel, supposedly. So this is very serious. That all of a sudden, you notice how this game gets played? For a long time we were told Iraq, they have the weapons of mass destruction. They're going to give them to the terrorists. They have ties with Al-Qaeda. Oops, no, that was wrong. Okay, Iran. Now, Iran, there's a lot more evidence that Iran has weapons of mass destruction. Ties with terrorists are going to pass weapons of mass destruction to them. A lot of people, including myself, wonder, what the hell was Bush doing when he got up and gave that speech and talked about the axis of evil? What's the connection between Iraq, Iran, and North Korea? But he was laying out strategic thinking of this group that's grouped around him, that's at the core of power now in the U.S. Whether or not they'll go to war with Iran or not, I don't know. They probably don't know. But I think this article is pointing to something very real. There is a very real danger of things like this happening with Iran or some other country. There is a whole program, a whole logic, a whole momentum, a whole dynamic that they have set in motion, objectives they have of hammering the world, beginning with the strategic area of the Middle East, into a different shape, more firmly and fully under the domination of U.S. imperial rule. And they are going to pursue this aggressively. Remember when Bush took office, a lot of the talk was, oh, well, you know, given the contested election and the controversial Supreme Court decision, Bush will have to rule by consensus and move more to the center. Remember that? Get your memory back. You can remember that one, too. What did Bush do? Right away, he nominated Ashcroft as Attorney General. That was a way of delivering a slap across the face or a shot across the bow to say, fuck that. I'm implementing my program. I don't care what you think about how I got here. So this is very real indeed. But what we have to understand is this is not a war against terrorism. A lot of people, even people who for very good reasons are upset about and oppose the Bush program, are confused about whether there is a war against terrorism. There is not a war against terrorism. What there is a war for empire to further expand and more powerfully fortify the imperialist rule of the people who run the U.S. and now control most of the world already. There is a war for empire in that sense. And at times, it will involve their getting into military confrontation with forces that could be identified as terrorists. But that's not the objective and the program and what's driving what they're doing. And it's very important to be very clear on that. I don't have time to go into all the reasons for this here, but I would recommend Larry Everett's book, Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda, or Noam Chomsky's book, Hegemony or Survival, or even the recent book by John Dean, who himself was involved in Watergate as part of the Nixon administration, has become sort of a liberal centrist, and has written this book called Worse Than Watergate, which is a very serious thing. It's a very catchy title, but it's speaking to something very real. Now, Dean believes there should be a war against terrorism, but he says that instead of that, Bush and Cheney and the rest are carrying out their own imperial agenda under the cover of a war on terrorism. And that is, in fact, what is happening. They had plans laid out for years in think tanks and among forces who are now key parts of the Bush administration, as well as all over the media, people like William Kristol, who laid out the objective of going after Iraq during the 1990s. And as a matter of fact, it's worth noting that the official policy of the U.S. in 1998 became, quote-unquote, regime change in Iraq. And Clinton says the only reason he didn't go to war is he couldn't figure out the exit strategy. Well, Bush hasn't been able to figure it out that well either. But they were determined to go to war anyway long before September 11th, long before Bush came to office. Cheney is at the center of a whole group of people. There's a book called The Rise of the Vulcans, which talks about this. A whole group of people that ever since the end of the Cold War have been hammering at this idea that we have to seize this opening now. And this was actually laid out explicitly in an official government document, a national security strategy document in 2002, where it openly talked about how the U.S. had to expand its domination in the world and could not allow any rival to emerge even on a regional basis, let alone on a worldwide basis. So these people have been at this, and this has been their objective since even before they came into office. And more broadly, as reflected by that regime change policy in 1998, this has been the objective of those who rule this country more broadly than just Bush and the people around him. Now, we should understand that while there is no war on terrorism, one of the things that should tell us that is one of the questions that's strikingly absent from the media is a very simple and one would think basic question in the context of a so-called war on terrorism. What is terrorism? How many times have you heard the media, whenever there is, which is not very often a presidential press conference, or in any other context, insist that the administration come out and openly say, what is terrorism? Give us a definition so that when you start a war, we can evaluate, according to your own definition, whether this is part of that or not. You never hear that from the media because this is deliberately an open-ended thing that can mean whatever they want it to mean. So it's useful and important for them to characterize this as a war on terrorism, a war, quote-unquote, which by definition is open-ended and never-ending, and in the name of which anything can be done. As they have said, Cheney said this explicitly, this war may last for generations. When did you ever vote on that? When was the question ever put to you in an election? Do you want to be at war for the next 3 decades? Never, because that's not how those things get decided. They set things in motion, and then you're forced to deal with what they've set in motion, because they run things and we don't. This war may last for generations, and they have repeatedly justified outrages on the basis of this war. even things which openly trample on the proclaimed principles of American democracy and openly thumb their nose at international laws, conventions, and treaties. And under the cover of this war on terrorism, they are in fact seeking to bludgeon into place whole new structures of power internationally, which even further extend, entrench, and enforce their global imperial domination, and radically new and highly repressive relations and forms of power within the U.S. itself. Now, one of the things that's most significant in terms of the latter aspect there, repression inside the U.S. itself, is this category they've come up with, enemy combatant. Now, it was recent enough that I'm sure even people outside this room remember that, or some of them might, that there was a Supreme Court decision about this recently. Because this has been a very controversial issue. What has happened is that Rumsfeld, Bush, Ashcroft, and the rest have arrogated to themselves, on the basis of executive decree, the right to declare anyone in this room or anyone else, U.S. citizen or otherwise, a quote-unquote enemy combatant. And immediately on the basis of that definition, to strip you of all rights, to put you in jail indefinitely, to deny you the right to a lawyer, to deny you the right to trial, to deny you the right to see the evidence against you. And it's a catch-22. You can't go through any legal proceeding to even challenge this. Well, finally, it was challenged in the Supreme Court, and in the context of the whole exposure around the Abu Ghraib prison and other outrages, including in Afghanistan with prisoners, and the context of a lot of struggle around this, the Supreme Court came out and made a decision which was widely but not accurately hailed as a great victory against the enemy combatant status. Because they said, yes, people should have a right to have a lawyer, and yes, they can challenge the status in a legal proceeding. But as was pointed out in an article by Clark Kissinger in our newspaper, The Revolutionary Worker, recently, there was a lot else that went into this decision that's important to understand. What they essentially did, while making a certain concession in the face of this exposure around their horrendous crimes in the prisons around the world, and a lot of people understand it's also in the U.S., and in the face of a lot of struggle, they made a minor concession. But what they did in the process was reverse the whole presumption of innocence. Now, if a person is, they didn't say the president doesn't have a right to put people in enemy combatant status. They upheld his right to do that. But then they said, the onus is on you. You have to prove, probably before some kind of military tribunal, that you don't deserve to be in this category. Good luck. You're stuck away in jail. You have difficulty seeing a lawyer. You can't gather any evidence. This is just a cosmetic change. And that the dangerous, sinister thing here, an insidious thing here, the sneaky thing here is that they've actually codified, institutionalized this enemy combatant category while making a few concessions at the same time. This is a whole new category that flies in the face of their professed principles in the Constitution. There's something useful to think about here in this context. I was reading a book called The Nazi Conscience by Claudia Kuntz. She also wrote this book, Mothers in the Fatherland, about the experience of the Nazis coming to power. And she made the point that the Nazis did not actually have universal allegiance of the German people, even after they came completely to power, consolidated their power, and crushed all organized opposition. They still had to take into account politically what a lot of the sentiments of the people in Germany were. And she chronicles and documents how Hitler actually, for quite a while, toned down his overtly anti-Semitic statements, instead talked more about the glory of the German folk and used code words that everybody knew what he was talking about. And at the same time, one of the main points she makes is in order to get a lot of the population that wasn't necessarily pro-Nazi to go along with this stuff, is they institutionalized it into the law. Laws that openly discriminated against Jews, restricted their activity, they institutionalized into the law. And a lot of people felt, well, as long as it's in the law and it's not just these gangsters running around outside the law, it's okay. And I think there's a very important parallel we should learn about here. Now, when I first started thinking about what I would say in this speech, I started reading this book, Worse Than Watergate, by John Dean. And he talks at the beginning of the book, he quotes General Tommy Franks, saying that if there's another major terrorist incident, we may see the end to this grand experiment that we call democracy. And I pointed out that Dean was saying, well, Dean was talking about what might that mean. And included in the things he said it might mean, besides things like martial law on a more or less permanent basis, is a suspension of the elections. Well, lo and behold, only a few months later, they're openly talking about the possibility of having to suspend the elections. They're making this a part of the accepted discourse in the society. They're getting people conditioned to the idea that if certain forces in the ruling class feel it's necessary, they can actually cancel the election altogether. So you won't have to hold your nose, but there'll be more serious things that will be required. This is indeed very serious business. And people who are upset about this, who are getting a sense of it, and there are millions in this country, are right to be extremely concerned about this. The question is, where should all this go? What form should this concern take? What expression should be given to it? And we could go on and on besides just these things about what the Bush program and those grouped around him is all about. A key part of this is a whole Christian fascist movement. People say, why do you call them Christian fascists? Well, basically for two reasons, because they're Christians and fascists. This is a fundamentalist movement which is completely tied up with, and the religious fundamentalism is the ideological glue for a whole reactionary social and political program, outlawing abortion, gay marriage, and insisting on traditional morality and all the vicious oppression bound up with that, including upholding white supremacy as well as male supremacy. A question that occurs to me that's interesting to pose is, have you ever noticed that the Bible Belt in this country, the place where fundamentalist religion is most deeply rooted and widely spread, that the Bible Belt is also the lynching belt? And that's not accidental, because especially in this society, to insist on quote-unquote traditional morality, upholding tradition, demanding unquestioning obedience to authority, cannot help, given the whole history of this country, but go along with vicious white supremacy as well as male supremacy. And I spoke to some of this in my book, Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones. One of the things that's interesting, part of that book is a polemic against William Bennett, who was an official in the Reagan government and is now a big spokesman for these people, although he got in a little trouble because he lost a lot of money gambling. But he's still been rehabilitated as a big spokesman for this whole crew of reactionaries at the core of power now. One of the things that struck me as interesting is, you remember here in recent months there's been all these abductions and then some beheadings in Iraq. And the news media can't stop talking about what a barbaric thing this is. Imagine beheading someone. And, of course, they don't bother to mention that during the 1990s, William Bennett openly called for beheading drug dealers in this country. And don't think that these people aren't serious about this shit. There's another interesting book out that I would recommend. It's called Republican Noise Machine by David Brock, who was part of this whole propaganda machinery of the right wing and then broke with it, partly because he's gay and he discovered they were very serious about their desire to persecute homosexuals. And especially in chapter 7 of that book called Ministers of Propaganda, he talks about the whole role of these religious fundamentalist forces and how key operatives in this whole fascist apparatus, like this guy Paul Weyrich or Weyrich, whatever his name is, organized them into a major force. And how when the satellite and other technology came online, they were able to become a major part of this reactionary propaganda machinery. So the danger posed by this is indeed very real and very serious. And we should make no mistake and have no illusions about this. I mean, think of the prospect of just canceling an election and everything that goes with that. And what will you do if you stake everything on the election when the election is canceled, if it is? This program and this direction does need to be resisted and, in fact, decisively derailed. That is a crucial challenge that must be taken up. From the point of view of our party, this must be taken up with the strategic orientation of and as part of building a revolutionary movement to overturn the whole system and structure of power in this country. But even from the standpoint of building opposition and resistance short of revolution, the Democrats represent no alternative. No alternative that is in the interests of the masses of people. Voting for the Democrats will not, in fact, contribute to defeating this program of Bush and the rest and the whole direction in which they're pushing society in the world. And beyond that, making the election of the Democrats or a Democratic president or Kerry to be specific, making that the key thing or the be-all and end-all of political activity, not only will not contribute to defeating this program and direction, it will lead away from and undermine the struggle that must be waged, the mass resistance that must be built to actually defeat and derail this juggernaut and everything it is seeking to bludgeon into place. As I put it in the book, Democracy, Can't We Do Better Than That? The very acceptance of the electoral process as the quintessential political act reinforces acceptance of the established order and works against any radical rupture with, to say nothing of the actual turning of that or overturning of that order. Let's look again at Kerry in this light, in light of how serious this actually is. Let's recall again his stand on the Iraq War, which I read at the beginning here. And let's remember, he was even in VVAW, for God's sakes, if you'll pardon the expression. This is a guy who protested and called out the crimes of the U.S. in Vietnam. But now, what's he doing? Because he doesn't want to be a protester. He wants to be president. He wants to be not the leader of you and me. That's not what the president is. He wants to be the chief executive of this administration, of this system of exploitation, oppression, and worldwide plunder. That's what he's running for. It's very interesting. I was listening to a speech. I saw it on C-SPAN by Al Gore a couple of months ago in New York. It was a heavy speech. He called for everybody below Bush and Cheney to resign in the Bush administration, anybody of any consequence, including Rumsfeld. He called out Bush in some really heavy terms. He said, for example, I had no idea when I accepted the results of the Supreme Court decision, even though I vigorously disagreed with it. I had no idea that Bush would completely trample on the rule of law. That's a heavy statement coming from Al Gore. And he made other similar statements. Now, a question arises here. He was very critical of the Iraq War, too, in that speech. The question arises here. Why is Al Gore saying these things? Answer, because he's not running for president. His role now is to draw in people who feel very strongly the things he's talking about to get them to vote for someone who's not going to say those things and not going to act on those things. That's the way this process works. And it was very interesting, with all this heavy stuff in the same speech, Gore said very pointedly, Kerry should not commit himself now to a course of action on Iraq. He should keep his options open, see what the situation is when he gets in the White House, and then decide what to do. And think about the implications of that and what's being said there. You go and vote for Kerry because you want to get out of Iraq, but he's not going to be beholden to that. He's openly telling you, I'm not committing to anything, except the statement I read earlier where we're not going to be driven out of Iraq. So we have to understand what's been unleashed, not just by the Bush crew, but more fundamentally by the whole system, but now in a very focused and concentrated way by the Bush crew. What's been unleashed is out there in the world now. And it can't be taken back. And everybody, including those who want to be part of the apparatus of running this system, have to relate to what's been set in motion, what this dynamic is. You see, for example, they talk about the question of credibility, as they did during the Vietnam War. Can't withdraw from Vietnam because then our credibility will be undermined. Now they're saying the same thing about Iraq. We can't withdraw from Iraq because our credibility will be undermined. Well, if you watch The Sopranos or if you've seen The Godfather, you know what credibility means. It means we rule over people by brutal and ruthless violence, and they won't be as afraid of us if it looks like we can be pushed out of somewhere that we are determined to stay in. That's whenever you hear them use the word credibility in that context, think of gangsters on a global scale. I remember I had a conversation with a friend of mine who had one foot in the proletariat and one foot in the life, as they say, and went back and forth between them. He was a very close friend of mine who unfortunately got shot down and killed in the 1970s. But he was also a very astute person. And one time I was describing to him how the system works and how the people run it, what they do, and how they think. And he listened for a while, and having had some experience with him, with this himself on a small scale, said, legit gangsters, huh? And that's very much to the point. They run a whole system that's based on gangsterism in a fundamental sense. And let's remember, as I pointed to earlier, it's this intervention and military aggression around the world hardly started with Bush. During the time that Clinton was in office, for example, he invaded Yugoslavia, using the excuse of the atrocities being committed by the Milosevic regime, which were being committed by them, but on a much smaller scale than what the U.S. does in the world as a whole. And as Chomsky pointed out in his book, Hegemony or Survival, the casualties that were caused in the period leading up to the invasion of Yugoslavia by the U.S., the casualties in the area where the controversy was centered, were not as great as the casualties that were brought about by the U.S. invasion and bombing itself. And that a large part of them, the large part of the casualties and atrocities that were carried out in Yugoslavia were actually carried out by the so-called resistance forces that the U.S. was allied with. But it's important to note that in the context of this invasion of Yugoslavia, which in other words did not save lives, and that wasn't the purpose of it, Clinton himself put forward this doctrine and openly articulated it, that human rights trumps national sovereignty. How different is that than the doctrine of failed states? If we decide... Now, you notice that human rights is another thing they don't like to define in any kind of universal way. Because guess whom that definition would be turned back against? But if we decide that anywhere in the world some people's human rights are being violated, we can intervene and overthrow a government. That's exactly, in essence, the same doctrine that Bush is applying now and applied in Iraq. Or think about globalization and the horrific effects that this has had on the environment as well as on people throughout the world, especially poor people in the third world. You know, for example, in Mexico, with NAFTA and the rest of it, the ruining of millions of more peasants has been set in motion by the implementation of NAFTA. That didn't occur under Bush. That was pushed aggressively by Clinton. There were massive protests against it in Seattle and other places for good reason. Or think about the Democrats and police brutality and repression. The murders of Taisha Miller and of Amadou Diallo did not occur under the Bush administration. They occurred under Clinton. You remember the case of Amadou Diallo. Was confronted by these thugs in police uniforms in the streets of New York City. He was an immigrant from Africa, didn't fully understand what they were saying to him. Tried to reach in and pull out his wallet to show his identification. They shot 41 times at him and 19 shots hit him and killed him. And of course they were acquitted. This didn't happen because Bush came into power. The Coalition Against Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of the Youth, along with some other people, has brought out a book called The Stolen Lives Book, which documents more than 2,000 people murdered by the police since 1990. Almost all of them, those who were killed, were unarmed. This didn't begin with Bush or the Republicans. Or what about the one-strike law? Most of you may be familiar with that. It's applied especially in the housing projects. This is a law that says, it's an administrative policy adopted by the Clinton administration along with their cutting back on welfare and ending welfare as we know it. And what does this one-strike law say? If you or anyone who comes to your residence in a housing project, for example, is arrested and accused, not convicted, arrested and accused of committing a crime, you shall be evicted from your public housing, from your residence in public housing. This was upheld by the Supreme Court, but it was adopted by the Clinton administration. There are stories of women in their 70s in a wheelchair, someone who was coming to administer to their needs, left their apartment, went out into the street nearby, was arrested and accused of having drugs. The woman was thrown out of her apartment in public housing. This didn't come about because of Bush. This was Clinton, who ran down to the South at one point to have his picture taken with a chain gang that was being reinstituted in the South of in the prisons in the South of the U.S. No one who lives in the United States and is aware of anything, which whatever else we want to say about him, Clinton is, can miss the symbolism of chain gangs in the South of the U.S. in particular. And all the horrific history that's bound up with that. That was not Bush, that was Clinton. And look at the Patriot Act. How many Democrats didn't vote for it, including Kerry? And under Clinton, even before the Patriot Act, we had the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which brought in whole new layers of repression, particularly against immigrants. People could be accused of being terrorists and thrown out of the country without any real legal procedure, and also made it much harder for people on death row, people like Mumia Abu-Jamal and others, to appeal convictions that were in essence railroads. This was not under Bush, this was Clinton. Here we are now, 50 years after Brown versus the Board of Education, and decades after the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement. We've had four Democratic administrations since that time: Kennedy, Johnson, Carter, and then Clinton. And where is equality? Where is an end to discrimination and white supremacy? Under Clinton as well, there were great leaps in the repression against immigrants. The militarization of the border with Mexico took a great leap. That wasn't Bush, that was Clinton. Or look at an issue like abortion. This is a fundamental issue touching on the very status of women in society and whether they can be emancipated or not. It's a fundamental issue of whether they can have control of their own reproductive process and the right to decide when and if they want to have children. We know there's this whole reactionary fundamentalist movement connected right up with Bush that wants to eliminate this altogether. And Bush has said openly, right now we don't have the circumstances and the culture to eliminate it, so we have to wait, i.e. work for the situation where we can eliminate it. But what about under Clinton and Gore? They upheld the right to abortion. This is the same stand Kerry is taking. But they insisted it should be legal but rare. Why rare? Why should a fundamental right of half the population having everything to do with their oppressed condition and the fight against that oppression be rare? And when you take that stand, what you're doing is helping to create public opinion that there is, after all, something fundamentally wrong with abortion. That yes, people should have the right to do it, but they really shouldn't do it because there's something wrong and maybe even sinful about it. And this helps create public opinion which greatly aids those forces that are moving to eliminate the right to abortion altogether. And unfortunately, this has an influence on people, including, very unfortunately, a lot of young women who never grew up in circumstances where abortion was illegal and get morally and politically confused because on the one hand you have this whole barrage attacking them for being baby killers and no one else among the powers that be standing up and saying that's nonsense and even bringing any science into the discussion. Even talking about how 90% of abortions are carried out in the first or more are carried out in the first trimester, the first 3 months, when the fetus is only as big as a dot at the end of a sentence and isn't a fully developed organism that can live on its own outside the womb, as these pictures these anti-abortion people parade around with try to portray. Where are the Democrats countering all that propaganda? For that matter, if you want to talk about baby killers, I was talking to some people about religion the other day. Just go to your Bible. Those Bible thumpers out there wanting to abolish abortion, these zombies walking around mumbling from the Bible, should read their fucking Bible. It calls over and over again for killing babies who are the enemies of the people of Israel. These are the people who actually uphold the call to kill babies. But where are the Democrats bringing out these points? Or where were the Democrats when the whole controversy arose around the Pledge of Allegiance and the phrase under God in particular? I'll tell you where they were. They were out with the Republicans chanting the Pledge of Allegiance and emphasizing the phrase under God. Not a single one of them stood up and said, well, you know, there is such a fucking thing as separation of church and state, after all. And there was someone, one of these commentators who said, well, you know, yes, some of these Democrats oppose it, but none of them dare say so openly. What does that tell you? None of them dare say so openly. None of them dares take a stand on a basic issue that religion shouldn't be promoted by the state, which is obviously what's at issue. When the guy Michael Nidau, who pursued this case all the way up to the Supreme Court, got in there, he did a much better job than most of these professional lawyers because he wasn't intimidated by the court and he had a consistent position that he fought for. And at one point they tried to say, well, you know, this is just sort of a phrase that doesn't really have any real religious connotation or implication anymore. And he said, I have a hard time believing that under God means no God. The whole point of the phrase when it was adopted in the 50s, and this is the legislative history that he also brought out, the whole point was to contrast this country with atheistic, communistic Soviet Union and China. That's why they put it in to be a religious phrase. But the Democrats couldn't even stand up for that. Well, what about the Democrats and torture? There's a thing called renderings that's going on right now. Besides all the exposure about torturing prisoners in Afghanistan and Abu Ghraib and Iraq, the fact is that right now the CIA and the American government in general take prisoners that they capture and condemn as enemy combatants or terrorists or whatever and send them to other countries where they can be more openly and fully tortured without any kind of restriction. This is an official policy. It's called rendering. What a euphemism. Cover up the criminal, brutal nature of this. Well, the fact is that Democrats, along with the Republicans, were given a briefing and informed by the CIA that this was going on shortly after September 11th. Where is their massive outcry in opposition to this? Now, what all this points to is the fact that in fundamental terms, the Democrats share the same strategic objectives that are being aggressively pursued by Bush and the like. They are representatives of the same system, and like the Republicans, they have to and do operate in the interests of that system and within the dynamics and confines set by the workings of that system. That's why they talk about how we can't withdraw because of a credibility problem in Iraq. And even to the degree that the Democrats do have disagreements, they are neither able nor willing to take the steps and to call into motion the forces and struggles that would be required to confront and defeat the whole direction in which things are being taken. You could see that in the 2002 election. I pointed this out in an article in our paper called The Pyramid of Power. Why was there? Did the Democrats not call forth massive opposition to the war in Iraq as it was building before the war started? During the 2002 elections, many people were begging the Democrats, please come out and take a stand against the war so we can vote against it by voting for you, and they steadfastly refused, just as they are now. Because they're caught in this contradiction. They need to appeal to and try to draw in progressive and oppressed people throughout the society who now are up in arms or not yet up in arms, but very disturbed about things in their tens of millions. They need to appeal to them and draw them into the process, but they cannot do the things those people desperately want them to do. They cannot do it because it goes against the interests of the system that they have to serve or they're out. And even if they wanted to, the alignment of forces within the ruling structures is not such they could get away with it. The Supreme Court is not with them. The officer corps of the U.S. military is not with them. It's riddled with fundamentalist Christians. It's a highly ideological and political officer corps at this point, even though it's not supposed to be. And they very fundamentally are afraid of the people they want to vote for them. They don't want to see you and me and the people from Watts and the people from Pico Union and the people from the Bronx. They don't want to see them out in the streets in millions demanding fundamental change. They're frightened to death of them in the same way that the Republicans are. And yet those are the people they have to try to get to vote for them. It's interesting. I was reading back and preparing for this talk. I was reading back a special supplement in our paper back in 1998 during the Clinton impeachment process called The Truth About Right-Wing Conspiracy and Why Clinton and the Democrats Are No Answer. And what really struck me, there's a lot of very relevant stuff. It almost feels as if it were written yesterday, because basically the same forces could already be seen in motion. Same contradictions were sharpening up. One of the things that really struck me in this article was that it referred to the fact that, if you remember, back in 1998 during the midterm congressional elections, the Republicans lost a few seats. And this was widely proclaimed to be a defeat for the radical right in the U.S. and a victory for what was called the moderate center. Now, what really struck me in reading the supplement was, guess who was identified as part of the moderate center? Clinton and Gore and the Bush brothers, Jeb and W. That was the moderate center, and this reminds me of an old joke I heard as a kid. A family in New England invited their Scottish relative to come visit them. And he came and spent some time with them. They took him out into the countryside and out into the woods and the mountains. And he said, "Hoot, man. This is a wonderful countryside you have here." And they said, "Yes, well, it's great, but one thing before you leave you have to do is you have to see a moose." So they took him out to this far remote area by a stream, and they waited for hours and hours. And finally this gigantic animal appeared, and they said, "There it is, there's a moose." And he had this astonished look, and finally, through his amazement, he said, "If that's a moose, I'd hate to see a rat." It takes a little while. Well, all I can say in this context is, if the Bush brothers represent the moderate center, I hate to see fanatical right-wing fascists. Now, more than a few people have fallen into the orientation, very good people, who in the face of especially the refusal by the Democratic Party to act in the way they wanted them to act, came out into the streets. People who'd never demonstrated before came out to try to stop the Iraq War, and as well as many people who were longtime political activists. And more than a few people of these people have fallen into the orientation that, quote, as they would say, "We tried mass resistance and it didn't work. Look at what happened with the Iraq War. Even with all the massive outpouring of opposition to it within the U.S. as well as all over the world, they still went ahead with it. Therefore," these people conclude, "the best we can do is vote for the Democrats and hope for the best." Well, this pessimistic view is one-sided and fundamentally untrue. And once again, it gets back to some of the things in this culture that we have to break with and move beyond. We have to get beyond this quest for instant gratification, even in the political struggles that people wage. Have to quit evaluating everything in terms of immediate results. This is what's promoted in the culture of this country all over the place. Immediate results, instant gratification, or else forget it. We need to develop a more strategic orientation in order to understand the importance of building resistance and the impact this can have and already has had on the political course of things in this country and around the world. Yes, it's true, this massive outpouring didn't stop the war in Iraq. Everybody remembers the insult hurled by Bush, "I don't listen to focus groups." Speaking of millions of people in motion, whom everybody knows, when you know, unless you have an all-out revolutionary situation in society, if you have millions of people in the streets, you have tens of millions who agree with them. Okay, so it didn't stop the war in Iraq, but look what it did do. partly because these other powers in the world, these other imperialists like France and Germany and Russia, have their own interests, which aren't down the line completely with the U.S. the way the British are. But in large part also because there was a massive outpouring in all these countries and around the world, these governments did not take a stand with the U.S., in fact denied it the mandate from the U.N. to wage the war in Iraq, which was not an insignificant political fact. Remember, just before the war started, there was Osnar, Blair, and Bush on some island. Even there were demonstrations against them, declaring that they represented the will of the willing to carry out this war. But they were denied not only a UN mandate, but more importantly, they were denied a moral mantle. They went ahead with the war, but they were not able to go ahead with an undisputed moral mantle of righteousness in waging this war. Far from it. This was to a significant degree stripped away from them. And that's very significant in itself and for the future. Think of this whole juggernaut and the next steps they want to take in this. It's become harder for them to carry through this, even though they're determined to do it, because people poured out into the streets in such a massive way and ripped away the moral authority and political legitimacy from this war. That's a tremendous accomplishment. Sometimes we don't even realize when we're in the course of struggle what we accomplish, because the ruling class and its spokesmen work very hard to keep us from summing things up correctly. So even though where we have an impact on them, they want to deny us the understanding that we have. They want to deny us any kind of a strategic orientation of building on what we actually accomplished. We have to start seeing this as a whole process of their dynamic versus the dynamic that we have to set in motion. Not constantly fitting within the political dynamic that they want to unleash, but bringing forward a different dynamic which isn't limited and constrained and suffocated by the political terms that they want to say are the only possible terms. We have to see ourselves, especially in these days, as locked in acute, ongoing struggle with them and their dynamic to disrupt it and to take things in a whole different direction. And it isn't going to be settled with one or a few battles. This is an ongoing and acute struggle, and we have to develop the orientation that's appropriate to that, if we really care about the things that we do, in fact, care about. And to people who insist that voting to get Bush out is the key thing today and everything has to be subordinated to that, these questions need to be faced head on. What will you do if, despite all the efforts to unseat Bush, he is reelected or, in some other way, remains in office? What will you do if you have put all your efforts into getting Kerry elected, and you have accepted this as the quintessential political act, the be-all and end-all of politics for now, and then Kerry is elected and assumes the presidency, and the same general direction, the same fundamental policies, and the same fundamental approach to and relations with the rest of the world are continued with Kerry as president? What will you do then? What do you want to emerge after this election? What do you want the political situation to be like? This is a question I want to keep coming back to. But from all this, it should be clear that anything, and in particular voting for Kerry and the Democrats, and more specifically, insisting that trying to get Kerry elected is the decisive and determining political act now, that this is not better than Bush. In fact, anything which has the effect of undermining and derailing the kind of massive resistance that is urgently called for, that is worse than having Bush remain as president. To understand more fully why this is so, it is necessary to grapple and come to grips with more fundamental questions. Let's begin then with the question of democracy, and in particular American democracy, and what this really means. To establish a certain foundation for this, let me begin by repeating three sentences I wrote recently, which are aimed at capturing some essential reality. In a world marked by profound class divisions and social inequalities, to talk about democracy without talking about the class nature of that democracy and which class it serves is meaningless and worse. So long as society is divided into classes, there can be no democracy for all. One class or another will rule, and it will uphold and promote that kind of democracy which serves its interests and goals. The question is which class will rule, and whether its rule and its system of democracy will serve the continuation or the eventual abolition of class divisions and the corresponding relations of exploitation, oppression, and inequality. Now, I told some people shortly after writing that if I were teaching a class on democracy in this college or any other, if I were teaching a semester course on democracy, I would begin by reading those three sentences and then say, discuss. Because we could take up a whole semester and more getting into all that's concentrated in those points. But the simple fact is, and what this is pointing to, wherever there is democracy, there is also dictatorship. You could, if you wanted to be provocative, and sometimes I like to do that, you could boil this down to a simple statement. Democracy, it's just a form of dictatorship. And this has been true from ancient Greece and Rome to present-day America. All these democracies that are hailed as the cradle and model for our civilization, like Greece and Rome, there was a small group that ruled the society that practiced democracy in its ranks, and the great majority of people were slaves without any rights whatsoever. And although the forms are different today, essentially the same is true. But this is a complex question, so let's get into it further and more deeply. As a bedrock, let me just put it this way. What exists in the U.S. with the outward form of democracy is in fact a dictatorship of the capitalist ruling class, or a bourgeois dictatorship, to use the French word. It is this class which completely dominates the economic life of this society, the processes and institutions of political power and decision-making, and the means and instruments of creating and molding public opinion and popular culture. And the democracy that exists under this system is bourgeois democracy. A democracy that exists within, is defined and delimited by, and serves this bourgeois dictatorship and the capitalist system of exploitation which this dictatorship enforces. What is loudly and incessantly proclaimed as the great shining example of freedom and democracy and the leader of the free world is in reality a system of exploitation and oppression presided over by a ruling class of capitalist imperialists, a system of exploitation and plunder not just in the U.S. itself, but even more viciously throughout the world as a whole. The essence of this rule is dictatorship. Now, there are reasons why, at least much of the time, and this is coming into question now very directly, but much of the time, the democratic form of this bourgeois dictatorship best serves the capitalist ruling class, at least in terms of how it rules, quote-unquote, at home. And this includes the important ways in which this democratic form, and in particular its electoral process, serves to give the mantle of a popular mandate to what this ruling class does within the U.S. and throughout the world. But when and where it seems essential to this ruling class, or to those who have come to dominate within this ruling class, they can and will seriously curtail or even outright abolish the democratic form and impose their domination through much more open police state repression and terror over the population. In other words, through a fascist form of bourgeois dictatorship. And in very real sense, this is what is on the agenda and being debated and in the public discourse right now. And if you think about it, the essential nature of this oppressive rule, regardless of which party was in power, has been shown throughout the history of this country and right up to the present time. Obviously, I don't have time to go all into this or we'd be going on for weeks. But just to cite and skim over a few examples. Much as they don't like to talk about it, this country was founded on genocide and slavery. And that was backed up by the armed force of the people who ruled the society. Otherwise, there would have been no genocide against the Native Americans and no enslavement, kidnapping, and horrors committed against people from Africa. That would have been impossible without the force of the state, the armed violence of the ruling class, to make sure that this happened. And after slavery, particularly in the South, but really throughout the U.S., we had the whole experience of the KKK terror, as well as an official system, particularly in the South, of laws and violence that enforced the system of segregation and serf-like feudal exploitation of black people as sharecroppers in the South for almost a whole 100 years after the Civil War ended and slavery was formally abolished. That, too, was impossible without the state, without the dictatorship of the ruling classes, without the use of their armed force to make sure that people were imprisoned and enchained in this way. Or the territory of the U.S. was expanded by the theft of over half of what was Mexican territory. That was not done through peaceful negotiation or persuasion. It was done through a war, a bloody war of conquest. Now, I recently had this movie about the Alamo and all this bullshit. But the real history there is that as two different systems of economic systems developed in the U.S., one centered in the North, which was a manufacturing capitalist system, and one centered in the South, which was a plantation slave system, they were coming increasingly into conflict with each other. For example, a great deal of the cotton that was grown by slaves in the South was shipped not to New England, but to England. And this is just one symbolic thing of the conflicts they were coming into. And part of this conflict approaching the Civil War in the decades before was a race to expand to the West in particular. And the annexation or the theft of Texas was a crucial part of this spread, this expansion to the West, and also a crucial part of this contest or this conflict between the capital centered in the North and the slave system centered in the South. And as everybody knows, Texas ended up being a slave state. That's what that war was all about, was to secure it for the U.S. and in particular for slavery and the slave system. People like, some of those people fought in Alamo, many of them were slave traders and overseers. And that's what happened after the U.S. took, Mexico had abolished slavery, but once the U.S. took it over, the slave system spread into Texas. That was not done without the violence, the organized, official, quote-unquote, legitimate violence of the ruling class through its government, its state.